Chapter 34. At a larger experience, we shall begin to take an absorbing interest in them like our cultivated countrymen from Amerique. Now it does give me real pain to speak in this almost unappreciative way of the old masters and their martyrs, because good friends of mine in the ship, friends who do thoroughly and conscientiously appreciate them, and are in every way competent to discriminate between good pictures and inferior ones, have urged me for my own sake not to make public the fact that I lack this appreciation and this critical discrimination myself. I believe that what I have written, and may still write about pictures will give them pain, and I am honestly sorry for it. I even promised that I would hide my uncouth sentiments in my own breast. But alas! I never could keep a promise. I do not blame myself for this weakness, because the fault must lie in my physical organization. It is likely that such a very liberal amount of space was given to the organ which enables me to make promises, that the organ which should enable me to keep them was crowded out. But I grieve not. I like no halfway things. I had rather have one faculty nobly developed than two faculties of mere ordinary capacity. I certainly meant to keep that promise, but I find I cannot do it. It is impossible to travel through Italy without speaking of pictures, and can I see them through others' eyes? If I did, not so delight in the grand pictures that are spread before me every day of my life by that monarch of all the old masters, nature, I should come to believe, sometimes, that I had in me no appreciation of the beautiful, whatsoever. It seems to me that, whenever I glory to think that for once I have discovered an ancient painting that is beautiful and worthy of all praise, the pleasure it gives me is an infallible proof that it is not a beautiful picture, and not in any wise worthy of commendation. This very thing has occurred more times than I can mention, in Venice. In every single instance the guide has crushed out my swelling enthusiasm with the remark, "It is nothing, it is of the Renaissance." I did not know what in the mischief the Renaissance was, and so always I had to simply say, "Ah, so it is, I had not observed it before." I could not bear to be ignorant before a cultivated Negro, the offspring of a South Carolina slave. But it occurred too often for even myself - complacency, did that exasperating, "T is nothing, it is of the Renaissance." I said at last, "Who is this Renaissance? Where did he come from? Who gave him permission to cram the Republic with his execrable daubs?" We learned, then, that Renaissance was not a man, that Renaissance was a term used to signify what was at best, but an imperfect rejuvenation of art. The guide said that after Titian's time, and the time of the other great names we had grown so familiar with, high art declined. Then it partially rose again, an inferior sort of painters sprang up, and these shabby pictures were the work of their hands. Then I said, in my heat, that I wished to goodness high art had declined 500 years sooner. The Renaissance pictures suit me very well, though sooth to say its school were too much given to painting real men, and did not indulge enough in martyrs. The guide I have spoken of is the only one we have had, yet who knew anything. He was born in South Carolina, of slave parents. They came to Venice while he was an infant. He has grown up here. He is well educated. He reads, writes, and speaks English, Italian, Spanish, and French with perfect facility, is a worshipper of art and thoroughly conversant with it, knows the history of Venice by heart, and never tires of talking of her illustrious career. He dresses better than any of us, I think, and is daintily polite. Negroes are deemed as good as white people in Venice, and so this man feels no desire to go back to his native land. His judgment is correct. I have had another shave. I was writing in our front room this afternoon and trying hard to keep my attention on my work and refrain from looking out upon the canal. I was resisting the soft influences of the climate as well as I could, and endeavoring to overcome the desire to be indolent and happy. The boys sent for a barber. They asked me if I would be shaved. I reminded them of my tortures in Genoa, Milan, Como, of my declaration that I would suffer no more on Italian soil. I said, "Adieu for me, if you please." I rode on. The barber began on the doctor. I heard him say, "Dan, this is the easiest shave I have had since we left the ship." He said again, presently, "Why, Dan, a man could go to sleep with this man shaving him." Dan took the chair. Then he said, "Why, this is Titian. This is one of the old masters." I rode on. Directly Dan said, "Doctor, it is perfect luxury. The ship's barber isn't anything to him. My rough beard weed is stressing me beyond measure." The barber was rolling up his apparatus. The temptation was too strong. I said, "Hold on, please. Shave me also." I sat down in the chair and closed my eyes. The barber soaped my face and then took his razor and gave me a rake that well nigh threw me into convulsions. I jumped out of the chair. Dan and the doctor were both wiping blood off their faces and laughing. I said it was a mean, disgraceful fraud. They said that the misery of this shave had gone so far beyond anything they had ever experienced before, that they could not bear the idea of losing such a chance of hearing a cordial opinion from me on the subject. It was shameful. But there was no help for it. The skinning was begun, and had to be finished. The tears flowed with every rake, and so did the fervent execrations. The barber grew confused, and brought blood every time. I think the boys enjoyed it better than anything they have seen or heard since they left home. We have seen the Campanile, and Byron's house, and Balbi's the geographer, and the palaces of all the ancient dukes and doges of Venice, and we have seen their effeminate descendants airing their nobility in fashionable French attire in the grand square of St. Mark, and eating ices and drinking cheap wines, instead of wearing gallant coats of mail and destroying fleets and armies as their great ancestors did in the days of Venetian glory. We have seen no bravos with poisoned stilettos, no masks, no wild carnival, but we have seen the ancient pride of Venice, the grim bronze horses that figure in 1,000 legends. Venice may well cherish them, for they are the only horses she ever had. It is said there are hundreds of people in this curious city who never have seen a living horse in their lives. It is entirely true, no doubt. And so, having satisfied ourselves, we depart tomorrow, and leave the venerable Queen of the Republics, to summon her vanished ships, and marshal her shadowy armies, and know again in dreams the pride of her old renown." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.